Hello, you're with Helen with the Talk and Information Center with readings from the New York Times Book Review. Today's date is Tuesday, February 10. And the next, the article is dated Sunday, January 25th, 2026. Sobering Thoughts, a useful entry in the growing canon of Quit Lit blends science and memoir to persuade readers to cut down on alcohol by Alexandra Jacobs. Excessive drinking rose during the pandemic, read one 2021 headline that I at first clocked that third word as rosé, that is, showed the extent of the problem. A no-nonsense English app called Try Dry, free of the saccharine affirmations, dumb games, and bids for money that characterize the American versions, has helped me cut back. Now Charles Knowles, a Colorado surgeon and professor in London, is putting the Brit in Quit Lit with an open-hearted new book, Why We Drink Too Much. Sober for a decade, thanks in part to AA meetings, Knowles writes that he doesn't want to bore readers with tales of his excess, but a few bubble up to the surface in and around many worrisome charts and graphs, like the fight with his father-in-law at his son's christening party held at an infamous London pub called The Blind Beggar, where the gangster Ronnie Cray fatally shot George Cornell in 1966, and outside of which William Booth, founder of the Salvation Army, used to preach. On one occasion, Noel's daughter's nursery school refused to release her to him because he was so intoxicated, and his wife, Annie, had to be summoned from work. On another, the child was left wondering where dinner was as he lay passed out on a couch. His nose got broken after a drinking altercation. He dislocated his pinky finger after falling off a bike. He had a George Bailey moment on the Tower Bridge, and most distressingly, he once sat under a mango tree in a friend's garden with a half-empty bottle of Bacardi and a five-round Smith & Wesson 38. Unlike Denzel Washington's pilot character in Flight, the author never performed under the influence. Alas, others have, he writes. It's a measure of the addict's commitment that his hospital had to remove the alcohol-based hand sanitizer outside ward entrances. Knowles lays out methodically what alcohol does to its consumers, how some are reliant, others repelled, and many more float around in a cloudy gray area. Reading about this is grim but grounding, like finding out that what the poets call love might just be some swirl of oxytocin and vasopressin. It pulls back the heavy velvet curtain on that old black magic. And yet, I have had to pinch myself that I wasn't having an affair with a strange man. Annie exults of his recovery as if aliens had come and taken my husband away, replacing him for a better version. The number of acronymed syndromes here is a little overwhelming, but if the science studifies, the intriguing memoirish parts might be persuasive. We get peaks of Noel's childhood during the skinhead era in the East Midlands town of Boston, Lincolnshire, and his dispatch to a boarding school 50 miles away, where he was hazed and bullied for, among other offenses, not knowing the rules of rugby. He received beatings with socks that had been stuffed with soap bars. Coming of age in Margaret Thatcher's Britain, Knowles believes, when the small glass of sherry at Sunday lunch was flooded by a more expansive drinking culture, printed him for alcoholism. He had his first liter and a half a beer at 13 on a school trip to Munich and went on to join Revelier's half comatose from grapefruit juice and vodka after parties thrown by a debauched drinking society at his Cambridge college. knows and bid to obliterate being in possession of the sort of internal filing system that has an elephantine capacity for toxic memories, he writes. It can feel like there is a washing machine of information going round from which my brain will selectively pull out the dirty clothes to torture me. There is a person here of debts that the self-help genre cannot accommodate, but how generous of him to throw out a life preserver to others rather than wallowing. Booth called gin the only Lethe of the miserable, referring to the mythical river of the Greek underworld whose waters enabled forgetfulness. But alcohol is also linked, Knowles reminds us, to the more deleterious forgetfulness of cognitive decline and dementia, and to a host of other maladies, including polyneuropathy, cancer, fatty liver, coronary artery disease, impotence, a.k.a. brewer's drip, psychosis, and so forth. Many choose to blow past these bummer facts and continue to tipple and calibrate. This dry January is dragging on a bit, is a mimi I received on the 2nd of this month. Hippocrates and Plato both thought moderate amounts of wine were medicinal, and let's not forget about the French. But younger people are drinking less, just as they are reading fewer books. Alexandra Jacobs is a Times book critic and occasional features writer. She joined the Times in 2010. Read Like the Wind, The Joy of Cooking by Jormana Kadib. Dear readers, no matter how much I'd like to sheath my fridge in tinfoil, the better to protect my home cooking from artificial intelligence, I know I'm in the minority. I can imagine the many practical uses of ChatGPT when it comes to getting calories on the table. But the books here are the antithesis of that sort of utilitarian, soulless prescription. They're indulgent accounts of culinary obsession, evoking an ironclad chicken kitchen brigade in Lyon, France, and a tiny East Village restaurant that changed how New Yorkers, and therefore much of the world, eat. They're also among the greatest love stories you can find, even if you've never fallen for braising or broiling or mincing before. Would you ask AI to outline why Anna Karenina loved Count Vronsky? Dirt, Adventures in Lyon as a Chef in Training, Father and Sleuth, Looking for the Secret of French Cooking by Bill Buford, Nonfiction 2020. Long before he was dancing in a top hat at renowned chefs' birthday parties, Buford was a keenly observant writer who also liked to cook. That hobby and his natural journalistic curiosity eventually led him to apprentice with the volatile restaurateur Mario Batali, working in his kitchen, chasing down his influences in Italy, and shaping the resulting pork and fennel-scented material in the book, Heat. Given subsequent revelations about Batali's abusive behavior, Heat is difficult to read now, but it does paint a damning and prescient picture. Dirt takes this formula and douses it in the French mother sauces. Buford finds himself among Lyon's bouchons, gazing up at murals of the local Saint chef Paul Bocuse and being roasted in a legendary kitchen for thinking he knew how to prepare an artichoke. One of the more gratifying elements of Dirt is Buford's admiration for his wife, Jessica Green, a wine savant with a strong handle on the French language, who made this relocation with their young twin sons in tow possible and even pleasurable. If you like eating figuratively language or the French language or all of the above, you are in luck. A representative factoid comes by way of a chicken with truffle shingled under its skin, set to be in demi-duel or half-mourning. The French have approximately 1 zillion fussy ways of preparing chicken. Buford's rapport with a local baker, Bob, who welcomed his apprenticeship as if he were an old friend, inspired an acquaintance of mine to observe, Buford is such a good writer, it's infuriating. Read, if you like, Quesnel's Richard Aulnay, The Bear. Blood, Bones, and the Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef, by Gabrielle Hamilton, Nonfiction, 2011. Okay, let's traffic in superlative. This is the best chef's memoir I've read, and I've read a whole bunch. Hamilton opened her restaurant, Prune, on the ground level of a tenement building on East 1st Street 26 years ago, and cultivated an insouciant, nearly all-female atmosphere that really did change, or at the very least predict, how we would go on to eat. Hamilton came from bohemian stock, the caboose of a large, half-French family in Pennsylvania, renowned for its lamb roast. You understand her eventual restaurant far better, knowing that much of its inspiration came from Hamilton's lean years traveling abroad and worrying about paying for her next meal. That's when she learned to dream in even finer detail. My hunger grew so specific, I could name every corner and fold of it. Salty, warm, brothy, starchy, fatty, sweet, clean, and crunchy, crisp, and watery. I like Hamilton for dispelling any overly romantic, Byronic ideals of how chefs spend their hours. Far fewer of them are devoted to coaxing miracles out of leeks and sunchokes than identifying free online lines and catching up on payroll. If you're looking to tap into an awe-consuming love of food, listen to the woman who still loves preparing it for a crowd after disposing of maggoty rat corpses and shoveling human feces from the premises at the start of a 20-year lease. Read, if you like, Mary Carr, Dreaming of Corsican Vacations, Running with Scissors. The next few articles are from the Sunday, February 8th, 2026 publication. Beyond the Whale, a retelling of Moby Dick with a young woman at its center, by William Giraldi. There ought to be an award for artistic audacity. Goethe believed audacity was integral to talent, and it ought to go to Ixalu Guo for her new novel, Call Me Ishmael. It's an astonishingly ambitious undertaking that even when it stumbles, does so with vivified striving. Consider the Promethean daring it must take to reimagine Herman Melville's American Prowess monument, Moby Dick, absolutely alone in its capacious grasp of the American sublime. Now consider it again when that imagining comes from a Chinese-born British author, better known for oblique personal stories about exile, identity, and language. While hewing close to realism, Guo immediately settles into the tenor of enchantment, a subtle register of near fairy tale that lets you know you're in the hands of a genuine storyteller. The narrator's father had hoped for a boy to call Ishmael. Instead, he got a girl and altered the spelling. By 1860, when Ishmael is a teenager living on the coast of Kent, both her parents and her baby sister have been buried, and her older brother has absconded for better days. Ishmael tweaks the pronunciation of her name, chops her hair, and disguises herself as a cabin boy on a merchant ship bound for New York. She is soon in New Bedford, Massachusetts, intent on becoming a whaler, an indefectible initiation into the manhood she seeks. What a curse to be a woman, to be a girl, she tells us. After that, if you know the plot of Melville's novel, you know Guo's. She has devised her narrative as Melville devises his, in short, potent chapters, though only a handful of her characters correspond directly to Melville's. After Ishmael finds a place on a whaling ship, Guo skillfully delays the captain's peg-legged entrance as Melville delays Hobbs, half black, half Wampanoag. The hellbent Captain Seneca rhapsodizes in biblical snippets Melville's own prowess and wrath-racked metaphysics. There was, remarks Ismael, an infinity of determination and willfulness in his pose and in his gaze. The conceit that affronts your credulity here is that Seneca's quarry is still a white whale that he and his crew call Moby Dick, even though, presumably, there is no Melville or an 1851 novel known as Moby Dick in the world of this book. The title was Melville's modification of Mocha Dick, the name of a real sperm whale with a grudge off the coast of Mocha Island. Characters also refer to the calamity of the Essex, a ship sunk by another malcontented whale in 1820, and an inspiration for Melville's novel. Also, if you're going to christen your characters with big names, Seneca, Moses, Hawthorne, Pound, those characters had better have an umbilicor, however thin, to be to the mighty ones who made the names immortal, or else the christening is just a trail of breadcrumbs leading nowhere, as it is here. Guo does well with the ship's name, Nimrod, and then because it rhymes with Ahab's ship, Pequod, Nimrod is the idolatrous God-hater of biblical legend. The meaning of Melville's novel, if meaning is what you must have, is found in the only element that makes literature, literature, the language. High register sentences tantamount to the high romantic epic of a self-begot captain intent on vengeance beneath a heaven that will not hear. Guo's ecology of language does not approach Melville's, but then who could possibly uphold the legacy, as Melville did, of Tyndale, Shakespeare, and Milton, the holy trinity of Moby Dick's ancestry? One must be patient with the foibles Guo allows to trespass upon her talent, from cliches, as clear as day, warm smile, to tautologies, sinking down, following behind, to anachronisms, hopefully, wasn't perverted into a sentence adverb until the mid-20th century, and trauma didn't refer to every emotional pinprick until the late 20th. The central misstep built into the very armature of Guo's narrative is that when you have a black captain raging after a white whale, and during the hecatomb of the Civil War, no less, it's all too easy to take Seneca as a cartoonish symbol for the enslaved and the whale as one for white iniquity. Seneca, then, cannot be apprehended as a man, which was the whole problem with slavery in the first place. He and the whale both become mere allegorical instruments, and these in jarring juxtaposition to Guo's other characters, many of whom do read as authentic individuals. Kari, the Polynesian harpooner based on Melville's Quiquig, though entirely lovable and protective of Ismael in her male disguise, is an exception. Almost all stereotype who speaks in Me, Tarzan, You, Jane, Pidgin. Accept the invitation to experience Guo's novel solely through the prism of political piety, and you will occlude what is best in it. The mastery scene construction, the galling details of whaler life and whale slaughter, the portrayal of Ismael's dolorous yearning and invalid hope, the sinew of its storytelling sensibility, the stabbing finale. You may not get Melville's aesthetic majesty or visionary power, nor what Camille Paglia referred to as his novel's operative gigantism, but you will get a bold new version that sends you back to its numinous source. Earth Angel. In this new novel by George Saunders, an oil tycoon on his deathbed receives a visit from a heavenly being, by Dwight Gardner. Once you start illustrating virtue, you had better stop writing fiction, Robert Penn Warren wrote. It was once difficult to imagine this dictum might apply to George Saunders. From the start, in the mid-1990s, he's been an American original, a briskly whiskered national acid. He's an ineluctably strange, dark, and funny writer whose work has some of Mark Twain's subversive wit. Kurt Vonnegut's cosmic playfulness and Donald Barthelme's laboratory blitzing of high and low culture. He's best known for his Booker Prize-winning novel, Linking in the Bardo, 2017, which is narrated by quarreling ghosts. But he's been at his finest in his short stories, which are often about victims and underdogs and bureaucratic absurdities. In collections like Civil War Land in Bad Decline, 1996, and 10th of December, 2013, Saunders' wit-to-power ratio remains stubbornly high. He's been a canny observer of the American experiment, lobbing us his insights from remote corners. His sentences have popped like the car lighters on 70s-era sedans. Back in an earlier internet era, the food website Chowhound had a department called Downhill Alert that warned readers when favorite restaurants were slipping. On certain gray days, I've imagined opening a vest pocket version of such a department myself. I've wanted to file some of Saunders' recent work inside it. Over the past 15 years or so, he's slowly drifted in his writing and other commentary toward becoming a kind of guru or secular saint, dispensing Buddhism-flecked feel-good messages about practicing kindness and bearing witness. He's yoked fiction to his project, describing it as something akin to therapy. In a viral commencement speech, he declared that reading can help human beings become more loving, more open, less selfish, more present, less delusional. In his nonfiction book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, 2021, about reading the Russian masters, he described people who've put reading at the center of their lives because they know from experience that reading makes them more expansive, generous people. This is a pleasant to imagine, and I suppose it's true up to a point, but who doesn't know a lot of big readers who are jackasses from head to toe? One thing's certain, the writers who insist on the morally improving nature of fiction and who robe themselves in the folds of wisdom or beneficence tend to be the ones to avoid. If there is any test that can be applied to movies, Pauline Kael wrote, her test applies to books too. It's that the good ones never make you feel virtuous. Saunders' new novel, Vigil, is slim, about the size of Mitch Albom's memoir, Tuesdays with Maury, or Richard Bach's novella, Jonathan Livingston Seagull. It's not as soft and shallow and saccharine and strenuously earnest as those books, but it's not impossibly far off. It's a hot water bottle in print form. It's going to be an enormous bestseller for depressing reasons. Like Linking in the Bardo, this novel slides around in the afterlife. It's about angels of both the amiable and the exterminating variety who crash down to earth to ease the passage, like birthing coaches of a reverse sort of certain humans. More specifically, it's about an angel named Jill who presides at the deathbed of an oil tycoon and determined planet despoiler named K.J. Boone. He's 87 and dying of cancer. If it's as if Clarence, the angel from It's a Wonderful Life, came down to oblige Mr. Potter instead of George. Boone is a scoundrel, a true villain, a man who, in a series of nesting dolls, would emerge after Kenneth Lay and Bernard Madoff. As Jill hovers near his bedside, A second and more avenging angel urges Jill to put the screws to him, to lead him as quickly as possible to contrition, shame, and self-loathing. Jill demurs. She wonders if Boone couldn't help being anyone but himself. This book plays determinately with notions of free will. Her mission, as she puts it more than once, also seems to be the author's, to comfort whomever I could in whatever way I might, for this was the work that our great God in heaven had given me. Sonder gets comic mileage out of his arguing slapstick angels. It's always been an easy laugh to make a holy person curse or take a pratfall. These angels shriek when they need attention, which is more often than you might imagine. Sometimes, embarrassingly, they drop other, smaller angels out of their backsides as if they were clumps of dung. At one point, Jill begins to sink into the earth. She's depressed and upset. And soon only the tip of my hairdo was visible, scootering along that asphalt surface, somewhat resembling the fin of a shark. Sandra's sense of humor is intact, but it feels less organic and more strangled than in previous books. Before she became an angel, Jill led a circumscribed life. She lived in Stanley, Indiana, drove a lime green Chevelle, and worked as a phone operator. She was blown to bits at age 22 by a car bomb meant for her husband, a cop. Now someone's left a Sharpie cup near her grave. In the afterlife, she feels fuller, wiser, more expansive. Jill pays attention to Boone's story. He feels misunderstood by all the lib dopes who've tried to pull him down. The world may be on fire, but as Elmore Leonard had a character ask in Swag, 1976, "What do you want, a job or clear sky?" Sonder's takes aim at elite, sanctimonious environmental activists. "How did you, Fran, physically get to the Minnesota Lake House when you still had it, dimwit? How did you make your way out of Minnesota and across Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, that one autumn to see the Magritte show in Boston you ended up being so crazy about? How did you get to that bat mitzvah in Palm Springs that was so transcended it made you rethink your ideas regarding the value of ceremony, or that wedding in Maui that had the fire jugglers, one of whom supposedly you made out with? You drove, you flew, you kombucha-making hypocrite." Sonder's angels can sink themselves into human beings and deliver unto them, as novelists do, the full force of a different human being. A problem with Vigil is that one doesn't feel the full force of these characters. The climate talk is ardent but familiar. The biblical counter-subversive injunction to love one's neighbor as oneself turns out to not be enough to hang a novel on. Sonder's is making his points too heavily, working to insert wisdom into our open beaks. The language. "I especially cherish my task. Let these ideas enter your heart, be moved toward elevation," can be banal. Sonder's newfound enlightenment may have done wonders for himself personally, but it's done his fiction no good whatsoever. This author has a lot of goodwill in the bank. He deserves it. Come back from the brink, Mr. Sonder's. Please, don't disappear up your own kazoo. Dwight Garner has been a book critic for The Times since 2008, and before that was an editor at The Book Review for a decade. Legends of Rock. A British archaeologist delves into the misconceptions and myths surrounding a complex ancient culture. By Joshua Hammer. In 1868, crew members of HMS Topaz, a British Navy frigate, acquired an imposing stone monolith known as Hoa Hakanana on the remote South Pacific island of Rapa Nui. The Admiralty gave the statue to the British Museum, where it caused a sensation. 8 feet tall, with an elongated face, heavy brows, and flattened nose, the ancient totem, or moai, thus testified to the aesthetic power of its creators. It also presented a mystery. How could such objects, and there were, the sailors claimed, nearly 1,000 of them, have emerged from a windswept, treeless, and nearly unpopulated wasteland? Some scholars posited that Rapa Nui was a vestige of an Atlantis-like submerged civilization, and that the original population of pre-Aryan giants had been replaced by a race of swarming savages. Others contended that the inhabitants had driven themselves to near extinction by war and cannibalism. In the 1960s, one Swiss pseudoscientist claimed the statues had been constructed with the help of extraterrestrial beings. Island at the Edge of the World is Mike Pitt's compelling attempt to set the record straight. A British archaeologist, long fascinated by enigmatic megaliths, Pitts directed excavations of Stonehenge before finding his way to Rapa Nui in 1994, where he watched a Japanese team raise 15 giant statues that had been knocked over by a tsunami. Pitts became caught up in the riddle of their origins and began looking for clues, drawing on DNA studies, undeciphered glyphs, and the research of a forgotten archaeologist who might have settled the matter a century ago, he argues, if tragedy hadn't overtaken her. Pitts had gone deeper than other writer in cutting through the miasma of misperceptions that shrouds the island, even if his work sometimes bogs down in numbing detail and he leaves important questions unanswered. The first European visitors to Rapa Nui were struck by the islanders' rich culture and agricultural resourcefulness. Although the island was probably settled 1,000 years ago by navigators from Polynesia, it didn't acquire its local name until the 19th century. The Dutch explorer Jacob Roggeveen arrived on Easter Sunday in 1722 and called it Easter Island. In the 1860s, a new wave of foreigners devastated Rapa Nui society. Slave traders kidnapped 1,000 islanders and sold them in Peru. European entrepreneurs confined those who remained in a corner of Rapa Nui, tore up their plots, and turned the land over to sheep ranching. Disease and emigration caused the population to fall from thousands to 110 by the time the crew of HMS Topaz came ashore. Most statues had toppled over through neglect and the severe weather that battered the island. Then came Catherine and Scoresby Rotherledge, seasoned English archaeologists addicted to the itinerant life. In 1913, with support from the British Museum, the Rotherledges set sail for Rapa Nui. Trapped there by war in Europe, the couple spent 17 months interviewing elders, studying glyphs carved on planks of wood, and grappling with the complex cosmology. The work, said one scholar, represented a milestone in Easter Island ethnography and an event of historic magnitude. Back in England, Catherine Rotherledge wrote a well-received book, but her marriage fell apart and many of her papers vanished. Overtaken by mental illness, she wound up committed to a psychiatric institution where she died in 1935. Her abbreviated project, Pitts argues, opened the way for more distortions of the islanders' history by everyone from the explorer Thor Heyerdahl to Boris Johnson, Gerald Diamond, and Kevin Costner, who produced a 1994 bomb called Rapa Nui that posited civil strife and environmental collapse. Pitts deftly picks up where Rotherledge left off. He retraces the original Islander's journey from Polynesia, a stupendous feat recognized in the 1770s by Captain James Cook, debunks archaeological evidence of a warlike culture, and makes a solid case that the inhabitants practice eco-nurturing rather than ecocide. He argues convincingly that the population produced and raised its moe over several centuries, and that individual clans each contributed a share. And he delves into the meaning of the monoliths, meant to summon the protective spirits of Rapa Nui's ancestors and guide the inhabitants on their life journeys. As moe culture died out, a new belief system arose centered on the Birdman cult. Each year, the islanders engaged in an extraordinary competition to collect the first sooty tern egg from a nearby islet and bring it to Rapa Nui, there to reign for a year as a kind of demigod or a Tangutu Manu. The cult was ended by European missionaries in the 1860s. Some of this is slow going. Pitts ventures deep into the weeds with many pages devoted to arcana such as rock mulching and Polynesian and South American botany. There's a bit too much throat clearing, which can make the book at times feel more like an academic treatise than a popular history. And Pitts left me confused about Routledge's research. He never makes it clear what was lost, where it went, and how much harm was done by its disappearance. It feels like he's reaching to build her story into a tragedy and mystery. But Pitt's wonder comes through it on nearly every page. He ends by returning to Hau Hakanana's Na'a, the subject of a long-running ownership dispute between the British Museum and island elders, and the alluring glyphs engraved on a monolith's back. The representations of bird beaks, fledgings, paddles, and vulvas were hidden for decades until the statue were relocated to an open gallery. The shift restored to public view the vibrancy and complexity of Rapa Nui's society, a process that Pitt's magisterial history now completes. Joshua Hammer is the author of The Mesopotamian Riddle, an archaeologist, a soldier, a clergyman, and the race to decipher the world's oldest writing. Profile: Jeanette McCurdy by Alexandra Alter. The author of the memoir, I'm Glad My Mom Died, hopes her debut novel will make readers uncomfortable. Jeanette McCurdy is often driven by rage. Rage led her to quit acting and pursue writing. It spurred her to leave unhealthy relationships and overcome a severe eating disorder. And it fueled her blockbuster memoir, I'm Glad My Mom Died, a painful chronicle of her traumatic years as a young actor who was forced into the spotlight by a controlling, emotionally abusive mother. Rage has been one of the most, if not the most, useful emotions, McCurdy said, over pasta at an Italian restaurant in Pasadena last month. Anytime I felt genuine rage about something, it's put my life on a corrective path that I have never looked back from. Anger also seeped into her first novel, Half His Age, a twisted story about a lonely teenage girl named Waldo, who instigates a sexual relationship with her married 40-year-old creative writing teacher. The fury she felt as she was writing Half His Age came from a deeply personal place, McCurdy said. Like the novel's narrator, McCurdy had a romantic relationship with a much older man as a teenager, at a time when she was vulnerable and deeply insecure about her body. When McCurdy was 18 and co-starring on the Nickelodeon show iCarly, a man in his 30s who worked on the production began pursuing her, touching her in ways that felt charged, telling her how mature she seemed for her age. His attention made her feel special and grown up, even as she felt coerced into sexual experiences she wasn't emotionally prepared for. She wrote about her relationship with the older man, whose identity she doesn't reveal in I'm Glad My Mom Died. So she didn't set out to revisit the experience in fiction, but the lingering discomfort shaped the novel in unexpected ways. I had a lot of unprocessed anger from that experience that I wanted to explore, and anger's a really useful place to write from, McCurdy said. Half His Age, which Ballantyne released in January, marks a bold new chapter in McCurdy's evolution as a writer, and an even more dramatic break from her past public persona as a Nickelodeon star. The novel has already caused a stir ahead of its release, landing on most anticipated lists and drawing support from writers like Tom Perrotta, Lena Dunham, and Gillian Flynn, who praised it in an interview as eerie and unsettling and believable. On the day we met, McCurdy, 33, was fighting jet lag, having recently returned to California from a much-needed vacation in Vietnam with her partner, whom she's been with for 9 years. In the months leading up to the trip, she had been putting in long days, often working until 2 a.m, as she frantically juggled writing projects, finishing scripts for the Apple TV series based on her memoir, doing final revisions on Half His Age, and then writing its screen adaptation, which she is attached to direct. McCurdy speaks the way she writes and vice versa. She's funny and blunt, often surprisingly and winningly open. A few times during our conversation, she seemed to catch herself before reverting to old people-pleasing, self-deprecating tendencies. She was hesitant at first when I asked about whom she sees as her literary predecessors. There's no way of answering this that doesn't sound awful, she said, weighing her response. After an uncomfortable pause, I asked if she felt like her novel was filling a void. She conceded that she hasn't come across many novels like Half His Age, with a complicated young female protagonist who is sexually aggressive, impulsive, voracious, and vulnerable all at once. I don't see it out there, she said. I feel I ought to stand by it and not shy away from it. The novel, which is laced with explicit and disturbing sex scenes between Waldo and her teacher, is likely to be polarizing, even among McCurdy's fans. On Goodreads, some readers lauded her for taking on a thorny subject, gross, vulgar, and uncomfortable, but compulsive reading, one 5-star review said, with a smaller contingent panned it as icky and explicit smut involving a minor. McCurdy knew she was venturing into risky territory by portraying the relationship as largely consensual, but she was careful not to sanitize the age gap. The fact that Waldo, who is 17 when the relationship starts, often thinks of him as Mr. Corgi during sex is one of many red flags McCurdy plants. Waldo notices Mr. Corgi's sour breath, flabby body, and broken blood vessels. Yet she imagines that he will love her if I wedge myself into a doll, a dream, a marionette with lifeless eyes, porcelain skin, and no needs of my own. Even the book's cover, a lurid close-up image of a girl's mouth as she deftly sucks on one of her manicured fingers, is both hard to look at and hard to look away from. I wanted it to be really provocative and visceral, McCurdy said of the cover. I didn't want anything abstract. I didn't want a fruit. I feel like we've all seen that. Please stop with the fruits. I'm so exhausted by the fruits. McCurdy is not afraid of alienating readers. In fact, she hopes readers feel unsettled and queasy at times, she said. When I told her that I often felt simultaneously disturbed and engrossed by the novel, she was thrilled. My dream, she said, beaming. To me, if something makes you uncomfortable, it's probably truthful, she said. If it doesn't make you uncomfortable, it's probably dishonest in some way. Growing up in Southern California in a volatile household, McCurdy was steered into acting from a young age by her mother, who started taking McCurdy to auditions when she was six. She appeared in commercials and won off-TV roles before landing a recurring part on iCarly as Carly's brash sidekick, Sam Puckett, a character that came to define her publicly, which she was mortified by. After her mother died from cancer in 2013, McCurdy, then 21, had an identity crisis. She'd never attended college. She spent her youth and young adulthood pretending to be other people on screen. She'd been in troubling relationships with older men and was at war with her own body, becoming dangerously thin from anorexia and bulimia. At 24, she quit acting and started writing, a decision she looks back on with satisfaction as ballsy. She wrote screenplays and spec scripts that went nowhere. She journaled and wrote a series of autobiographical essays about finding herself in her 20s. "I had so much in me that I'd been wanting to say for so long," McCurdy said. Much of her early writing was raw, almost like an exorcism. "None of those things will ever see the light of day," she said. Then came her memoir, which went on to sell more than 4 million copies globally and drew rapturous reviews. Its success transformed McCurdy from a former child star into a literary heavyweight. Maria Semple, the author of the best-selling novel, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, said that McCurdy's ability to spin a complex, nuanced tale about her lost childhood and self-discovery made it clear from the start that she was a serious writer, not just a celebrity peddling scandalous stories about the entertainment business. "She seems incapable of sentimentality," said Semple, who's become a friend. "She has this instinct for the mordant detail that would be the envy of any writer." McCurdy first had the idea for the story that would become half his age at 24, traveling on a bullet train through Japan. It wasn't until about 7 years later that she finally felt ready to pursue it. In the fall of 2022, she sold the novel to Ballantine in a reported 2-book, 7-figure deal. If you loved her memoir, there were aspects of her voice that you would still recognize and appreciate and respond to, and other ways in which she grew even further as a writer, said Jennifer Hershey, the publisher of Ballantine Bantam Dell. "She's constantly examining herself and forcing herself to write about things that are uncomfortable but true." From the start, McCurdy knew that she didn't want to write a conventional story about a victim and her abuser. "That's frankly boring to me, and I think we're past that culturally. I think we can afford more nuance and gray areas," she said. "I see this as a story less focused on the taboo itself and more on the psychological examination of the young woman who's experiencing it and all the contributing factors that allowed her to fall into this relationship in the first place." At one point, McCurdy's editor suggested that she tone down some of the explicit sex, but McCurdy didn't want to use flowery language or euphemisms to describe their encounters, which could have romanticized their relationship, she said. "I try to go back and do the flowery thing. I couldn't write it," she said. "I feel sex is often explored in a romanticized, glorified way, or it's kind of cute and clumsy and quirky, and I think it's really those things." McCurdy, who is writing another book, also a work of fiction, hopes women will relate to the story. She's already gotten a barrage of messages on social media from women who have struggled with skewed power dynamics in relationships and are eager to read the novel, she said. "Everybody has some relationship where they look back and go, I've got some questions about that now," she said. "I'm glad female rage is resonating because that's something that I haven't seen explored in the way I wish I'd seen it explored." She also hopes some men might read half his age. I think good men will take away the right thing, she said, adding that jerks, she used a stronger word, aren't going to read it. They're not in the bookstore, she said. I don't know where they are. On Pornhub, hours a day. Alexandra Alter covers books, publishing, and the literary world for The Times. Hot for Teacher. Jeanette McCurdy's first novel confirms her gift as a chronicler of disaffected girlhood by Brittany Newell. Jeanette McCurdy likes to make people uncomfortable. This is perhaps best exemplified by the title of her smash hit 2022 memoir, I'm Glad My Mom Died. That book is a staggering thing, a clear-eyed account of her childhood as a Nickelodeon TV star with an abusive stage mom that is somehow both haunting, tender, and funny. Half His Age is McCurdy's first novel, a reverse Lolita tale that dares you to flinch, squeal, and or chuck your book out the window, but ultimately rewards the fearless reader. Though it's a classic Bildungsroman, the reading experience felt more like watching a slasher flick, with me shaking my head and shouting to an empty room, "Don't answer his texts! Don't go to his house! Don't get your period in his closet!" This is a bold and unapologetic novel for edge seekers, doom scrollers, latchkey kids, horn dogs, and all those who love hard. Our protagonist, Waldo, is a wry 17-year-old Alaskan who spends her days slutting around with boys she finds boring, blowing her savings on shin hauls, working at Victoria's Secret, and judging everyone around her with preternaturally zingy one-liners. Her mother is a sex and love addict. Her father is out of the picture. Everything changes when Waldo develops a crush on her creative writing teacher, Mr. Corgi, a paunchy 40-year-old haunted by broken dreams. Naturally, he's married. He resists Waldo's come-ons at first, but not really. They begin an affair, sneaking around and having sex in high-risk settings like the bathroom during prom. Like most men in age-gap relationships, Mr. Corgi gets off on telling Waldo all about his favorite things. A clockwork, orange, David Foster Wallace, black and white movies. To the reader, he's a walking red flag. To Waldo, he is a delicious escape. What McCurdy does frightfully well is invoke the particular psychosis of teenage girls, the lunacy that would lead a big-boobed wisecracker like Waldo to fall for a sad sack like Mr. Corgi. At the beginning of the novel, I found myself tormented by Waldo's pursuit of him, by her porn star cosplay as they boinked in his car. We twist around so I'm on top, she informs us, my knee pressing into the Cheerio crumbs ground into the seat cushion. And he tells me that I feel amazing, and he asks if I'm his good girl, and I say yes. Then again, what is teen girldom if not a manic vacillation between pretend wannabe Jezebel and heat-seeking little animal? I think of that line from The Virgin Suicides uttered by a suicidal tween. Obviously, doctor, you've never been a 13-year-old girl. It is this longing, this instability, this hunger to be touched that McGurdy captures so vividly in Waldo. Half His Age becomes a slow burn, edging the reader as we beg Waldo's prefrontal cortex to develop or, at the very least, for her to see what we see. This dude's a loser. Besides the obvious Nabokovian echoes, underage girl, oh schmuck, I am reminded of Bret Easton Ellis's American Psycho while reading. McCurdy brings exacting attention to material things in her book, to the fast fashion products and name brand shampoos Waldo buys in a fugue state. One chapter opens, tab, 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 add to cart, add to cart, add to cart, add to cart. Knitwear and bag charms and brown Mary Janes, jumbo scrunchies and animal print claw clips and fox suede kitten heel boots that can handle Alaska snow, but I don't care. I keep adding. Both Waldo and Patrick Bateman are unreliable narrators with shifty or inchoate senses of self. Waldo because she is, well, still a child, and Patrick Bateman because he is, well, a psychopath. Each clings to the belief that their stuff can define them from the outside in. Sex is, of course, another way we try to be made real, witnessed into fleshliness when we feel like hot air. I fell so close to Waldo whenever she got ready for a date with Mr. Corgi, tearing up her closet and digging through her things, imploring them to offer her sex appeal, yes, but also coherence and stability. Is there a level of beauty one can reach where they become undeniably wanted, she asks? And am I one lip-stained shade away from that level? Spicy Sienna didn't work last time, but maybe Berry Queen will. This is what Half His Age is ultimately about, scandal and sex scenes aside, the dead end of longing, whereby you ask people or things for the love they can't give you, and how lonely this mismatch can feel. Waldo asks, what marks the rite of passage from girl to woman? A certain age? A broken heart? A fed upness? A real bra? I must confess, I don't know. Brittany Newell is a writer in San Francisco. Her second novel, Softcore, was published in February 2025. The Morning After. This novel dispenses with familiar portrayals of grief in a tale of migration, loss, and memory by Nicolas Medina Mora. If you, like me, have coped with an earth-shattering loss by binging on literature about mourning, you'll probably come across many books that rely on cliches derived from the obsolete psychiatric framework known as the five stages of grief. Fortunately, a rising star of Latin American literature has written a novel that refuses to reduce grief to a scheduled tour through ennobling sorrows. Recounting the furious bereavement of a woman who cannot come to terms with her brother's suicide, Brenda Navarro dispenses with fairy tales about acceptance and considers mourning as a kind of backbreaking labor, like childcare or house cleaning. Her novel, Eating Ashes, opens with the unnamed narrator already in the throes of grief, but the plot begins more than a decade earlier. After her mother leaves Mexico City for Spain in search of work and freedom, the narrator becomes the primary caretaker of her younger brother Diego, a sensitive boy who waves at airplanes in hopes that their mother might be coming back. But when the siblings finally make it to Madrid, the narrator discovers that Spain isn't the paradise her mother had promised. In Mexico, you could say we were poor. In Madrid, though, people still looked at us like we were poor, but also like we were scum. Full of resentment, the narrator moves to Barcelona, where she does the same thankless work that her mother and countless other migrant women do, cleaning, nannying, elder care. But Diego has it worse. Bullied at school, accosted by racists, harassed by the police, he grows into a bitter adolescent simmering with rage. His death opens a crack in his sister's mind, unleashing memories and recriminations with no discernible chronology. This nonlinear structure accurately portrays grief as a cacophony of ricocheting feelings. It's also flexible enough to accommodate Navarro's impressive study of Latin American workers in Spain, who, unlike many of their U.S. counterparts, share a mother tongue with their xenophobic hosts. Misunderstood by Spaniards, Diego retreats into a linguistic fortress of Mexican slang, a private language of insults full of sound and fury. While the translator Megan McDowell handles these subtleties reasonably well, at times she does a disservice to Navarro's catalog of Spanish dialects. In a crucial passage, McDowell renders pachita, a demeaning term for Latin American women that she elsewhere leaves untranslated, as a slur that conflates Iberian condescension with American hate, wetback. At this time, we're out of time, and pick it up next time.